So I was at home and I thought, well, okay, I'm going to speak about the third and fourth foundation. I wonder what I said about it. So so I picked up my book. And you have to understand, when you write a book, you read it so many times and you edit it so many times and you get sick of it. You get sick of it no matter what you've written, right? So now it's been probably a year since all that transpired. And so I picked it up fresh. And I thought, wow, this stuff is really good. I mean, I was reading it as if I hadn't read it and as if I hadn't written it. And it was, so I want to encourage people, as I would another author, actually, to really give this thing a going over. You know, the exercises are all in line with the themes of the book, and I will have a book signing at the end. And if you remember at the book signing to write your name before you come up to the desk, and if you come up just, you know, during the day because you're not going to be able to stay here for the book signing at 4, write your name down. It's so hard for me, given what I'm having to do and the thoughts that are going on, to try to remember individual names as they arrive. And you can make it much easier just having a little you know, post-it there that has your name already on it. Even if you're, you know, staying with me or my sister. And believe me, I've had very many awkward times when I know the person so well, and yet, anyway, you understand. So we went through a lot yesterday, and I'm just giving you the brushstroke of this book. But I want to read something from the Buddha, which this is one of my favorite passages, because he doesn't play around, you know. Some of us like to go to talks because they're entertaining and they're story driven and all, you know, that never was my appeal. I wanted to know what was true. Just cut all that stuff out he does it so succinctly in some of his writings, and this is one of them. So this is a questioner, and he says, is it possible, teacher, meaning the Buddha, by traveling to reach a far end of the cosmos, to find a place where one does not take birth, age, or pass away? To which the Buddha replied in two parts. I tell you, friend, doesn't the truth move you? I tell you, friend, that it is not possible by traveling to know or see or reach a far end of the cosmos where one does not take birth, age, or pass away. Now listen to this. But at the same time, I tell you that there is no making an end of suffering and stress without reaching the end of the cosmos. Yet it is just within this fathom-long body, with its perceptions and intellect, that I declare that there is the cosmos, the origination of the cosmos, the cessation of the cosmos, and the path of practice leading to the cessation. He's saying it's got to end. He's saying that everybody who stays within this paradigm, this cosmos, this world that we know, this universe that we understand, will be confined within the laws of old age, death, decay, impermanence. There's no escape if you remain within this. But in order to escape, you have to end this world. Now, for people who are new to Buddhism, that sounds like a nihilist or an anarchist or something, where there's destruction involved. No, it's not what he's saying at all. He's saying the way we perceive ourselves within life, the view that we hold that sustains this paradigm, will maintain itself. And in its maintenance, you will be governed by its laws, which are the laws of impermanence and death. And you cannot escape that if you fly to Mars or to the outreaches of the universe. And we can't, and he's not playing around. When he says, this thing has got to end, or you will continue. Yes, you can make your life better, and much of Dharma practice is trying to beautify that, make it less caustic, less argumentative, less conflictual. You can do all those things and stay within this cosmos. You can decorate your room, you can beautify your appearance, but you remain within this cosmos. And he's pointing to a complete shift of paradigms. And that's where he's taking us on this four foundations. He's systematically showing us the end of the cosmos, because the cosmos on which our lives are built and our assumptions are made is imaginary. It's fantasy. It's based upon the circuitry of an organism that was governed by its survival needs. If I'm to survive, I need to know what threat is out there, and I need to see that threat as separate from me, who's trying to survive from that threat in the opposite direction. And he says, okay, so it's now been millions of years in which we have been encased in this virtual reality, and we don't know how to get out of it. And so we try to search our way out of this cosmological view. Teachers, places, everywhere we go, we look under every rock. Is there a secret here that will allow me to better myself or escape or something? And the tools at hand are the tools that we have always used, our mental acuity, our reason, our judgment, our intellect, because that's all we've known within this cosmos. And then comes the Buddha's teaching, and we try to apply it to the logic of that same set of laws, the same strategies. That's not the end of the cosmos. And perhaps it's sufficient for some of us in the room to just allow ourselves to be beautified and to die a little more peaceful than if we had never picked up Dharma practice at all. And that's fine. If that's your course, that's fine. That's what you wish. No one should try to stop you or argue with that particular path and road and direction. It's fine. But my teaching and what I'm going to be saying for the rest of my life, so you can get it and not come back if it doesn't work for you, is the end of the cosmos, is the freedom that's available here. I'm passionate because I love it. If you hear it as some kind of, that I'm berating you, don't listen to it that way. This is heart. Because there is an end to this. The end to the betrayal of the virtual realities. Because once we have located ourselves within this cosmological phenomena, this virtual reality we call our home, then the situation of the world as we see it now is going to perpetuate. It has to. What do you think? We've been around 2 million years as a human species. evolved into this, and look at the mess we're in. The mess doesn't end by fighting the mess with the intellect. There's 11 billion of us, or some number, 7 billion of us on this planet, and we're all crashing into each other with increased frequencies. That's why all this is happening. That's why the climate is in. We don't know how to cooperate, how to walk in parallel lines to one another and slow walking instead of crossing each other's path. We don't know how to do that. There's 7 billion of us and everybody's crossing our path. You see, it's reached a crescendo now. And I hope that urgency that I feel, obviously, I can impart, because all of us need to feel that. That's how urgent it needs to be before we turn off the mechanism, so we say, this is not working, period. Not that I can make it work, not that I need to push it this way, and not that I need to self-prove myself into making it work better, but to end the cosmos. And we can't do it through the normal logic that we approach a problem. We can't do that. And you feel helpless. And that's the message. That's the Buddha's, the Buddha gave us the way out. Because we would still be running around looking under every rock for the secrets that would allow us to get out if there wasn't a clear definition and path to do so. Now that path can be used partially or can be used in totality. And it has to be used in totality if we're going to end the cosmos. And yesterday we examined how we have fictitiously represented the world, how we create objects from our internal mental responses, reactivities, and conjectures, and above all, our memory. We create the yous and the thises and thats that we interact with. And at the same time, assume, because it's just an assumption, it's not an observed assumption, or the assumption would never last. It's just an assumption that we play out from, never exposing itself to the very awareness that would allow it to be known. And if you notice, the last thing you want to do is to look internally at that depth, because it exposes the end of the cosmos. And we want to keep the cosmos going, so we'll look out from there, taking a stand upon ourselves as being the one fixture I can count on. But when we look inwardly, we see that it's an imagination, it's a fantasy. I can imagine, you know, I went over to the University Village, and I never had done virtual reality, and I went into the Microsoft thing there and I put on the glasses and I went, whoa, this is a different world. None of it real. But I was playing golf and hiking up some mountain. And I was like, everybody looking in the window must have thought, this guy's crazy. You know, I was like, and I was doing it. You know, it was a world. It was a world. I'd never done that before. It was an amazing world. It may even have some use. But not when you want the truth, it doesn't have use. It doesn't have use when you want to understand, that you feel the limitations of being imprisoned in that. You want to take the glasses off, what do? When the glasses have now been internalized. If the solution were beyond possibilities, if it were like, okay, this is how it was framed for me. Just think in terms of zillions of lifetimes. A bird that passes a silk scarf across a seven high mountain high, it'll take the number of sweeps of the bird's silk scarf to wear down the mountain. That's how long we've been around. So get on with your life. Because that's the message. Well, God, I wonder how far the mountain's been worn down in my lifetimes. No wonder I feel so, well, I might as well just get on with it. But you don't get on it with any enthusiasm. You don't show up for getting on with it. You get on with it in a kind of a passive, like, oh God, another life. You know, it's like that kind of, that sickens me. Because all the vitality that we need to end the cosmos has been refuted, has been this is coming out very sharply today, but it's not, just understand the tone. So then I'm serious now. It's like, have you ever had a project that you start out and like, okay, I'm the only one that can figure this out. I can use cues, but I'm the only one that can figure this out. Now let me be serious about this, because my life depends upon it, literally. I either stay within the paradigm of suffering and agony, or it can be shifted. So then I ask questions from the assurance of what, the stability and assurance and the fundamental principles that I've been standing upon, that I've always asked questions out from. That is, the I is the certainty. And I've always asked, how can I, what do I need to do? How do I improve? How do I beautify this? I never ask, what am I? I ask questions from the solidity of self about how to improve the solidity of self. The sense of I is never questioned. And that's why it maintains itself. Because the principles on which this cosmos is based have to be proven to be not true. And so we have to go back to where we're standing, the rock that we're standing upon, and inquire. And that's what the first foundations did. He says, okay, the rock that you're standing on is the body. You've taken it absolutely as the dividing difference between you and the other external objects of the world. And it's personal to you, and it's yours for the rest of your life. Now what is it? Well, I mean, it's me. It's just, no, what is it? You mean like, what is it, how, in science? No, what is it in experience? And what is it when I experience it without knowledge and memory? Because if I just bring what I've always known it to be to what it is now, it'll never be more than what it's always been. So I've got to enter a new frame of reference, which is a not knowing, which is a seeing directly. Without memory and remembrance, without knowledge. So I can sustain that, because knowledge is something I add to something to provide safety, but I'm not looking for safety now. I'm looking for what is true, and that will take me through my fear, because I protect myself from my fear with my knowledge. If I know something, I'm not afraid of it. If I let go of that knowing, now it comes back into its original form, which is unknown, and now I have anxiety about it. You see? So we're not going to get out of anxiety and fear. We got to go through that. We got to be stronger than that. So what is this thing? And it, the balance, when you enter, as we did in the guided meditation yesterday, you enter the body, it doesn't maintain its divisive, it doesn't maintain its definition, and it doesn't maintain its boundaries, physical or otherwise. And you do that in the mind, and if you start letting go of the way we contain the mind inside the brain, and you start letting go of those boundaries, the whole thing starts opening up. We're moving outside ourselves, outside of the rigidity of our knowing, our own knowing. And then the Buddha says, okay, so how? We have to go deeper than just having the experience of that, because you come back into yourself and you don't know the mechanism through which that knowing arose. That certainty, that memory, that you don't know how that works. So there's no interceding. There's just a continuation of it. So he takes us into the feelings, which are the bedrock of how this whole thing grows into the sense of division, to the you and the I. And he shows that that's happening moment after moment because of our temptation and need to want to be bathed and soothed in life. We want what's pleasant, and life is not offering what's pleasant all the time. And so we're left, well, I mean, I don't want to go to what's unpleasant. Well, there's the problem, because that's what also is coming at you. And see, what's happening now is the movement from the second foundation to the third foundation is that as the unpleasant comes in, that's the moment. That is what's happening. The unpleasant is. And we barter with is to make it a was or a will be. So the isness of life is all that is. But the mind, because it's light speed, develops a monologue or a dialogue, the voice in our heads, which starts arguing at is, as if it wasn't is, it was somewhere else. And that it can operate and manage and control is from the sense of being outside of is. Now we have a new problem. We have sufficiently looked and examined at the objects of the world as being replications of our inward imaging. And so the sense of I and the sense of what the object is arise together. We saw that in the first two foundations. But we're still making something out of something. There's still something in there that we can blame. Yes, it's the mind. The mind is the problem. So now I've got, you know, but now we've made something evil out of the mind. We've made, as long as you have one something, you have all the somethings. One something leads to everything, the plethora of appearances that we see, and the objects themselves. All you need is one. And as you stay, if you've eliminated and saw through your sense of self as being empty and the world as being a reflection of that memory being imposed and superimposed upon appearances of the world, and you've seen that, you still, and you think, okay, it's all mental. It's all the mind that's doing it. The Buddha says, okay, third foundation. He says, let me show you how this magician, this trickster works, called the mind. Now we're going into the mechanism of virtual reality. The mechanism. Having understood the emptiness of body, the emptiness of self, still the virtual reality is there. It's not as attractive, it's not as convincing, but the mind, I've got to take care of the mind, I've got to watch this mind, it's still something. See, this is, now we're going way out there. Because you're going to go to the edge of the cosmos, you got to go way out there. You can't stay safe. And the third foundation shows the emptiness of mind. Oh my God. Now I don't even have a villain to chase down. But what? How does it show us that? It's the most simple thing. He says it so simply. This is just, when the mind is constricted, he discerns the mind is constricted. When the mind is scattered, he discerns that the mind is scattered. When the mind is concentrated, he discerns the mind is concentrated. When the mind isn't constricted, he discerns the mind isn't constricted. When the mind isn't scattered, he discerns the mind isn't scattered. And when the mind isn't concentrated, he discerns the mind isn't concentrated. Now that's like, okay, that's too simple. Let's move on to the real teaching. No, this is not simple. Not when applied, it is not simple. It's simple, but it's not simple. It's simple, but it's not for a simpleton. Okay. Now, you see, what is he saying here? He's saying everything that appears in the mind, he establishes an appearance and then he establishes its opposite. And he says, you just discern it. Discern what's going on. Don't do anything about it. Just discerning is awareness, seeing. It isn't me thinking and intellectualizing. Discerning is seeing, raw seeing. Okay? So no matter what is seeing, that is held as well as its opposite within the seeing. What happens is that we dispute what is seeing because of that ponderance we have for pulling back and having a dispute with reality. Because we think we can argue with, oh God, I'm not concentrated enough. I need to focus in on concentration. And so, oh, I'm still not concentrated and my mind is wandering. All of those are coming from intellectual responses of what the mind is doing. And the Buddha is saying, take that away. You can have no dispute whatsoever if you want to see the end of the mind itself. As long as the mind is divided by what appearance arises in the dispute about that appearance, then you have a mind which is struggling by definition. But what if you wouldn't allow that struggle to persist? What if no matter what was coming up, concentrated, non-concentrated, anger, happiness, but anything in there, he's just everything in there without dispute and do nothing about it. Do nothing about it? Do nothing about it. And if you do something about it, allow that to be seen. So that the seeing is more primary than the appearances that arise. So you're not in argument with yourself. A mind that is in argument with itself is a divided mind. What does a divided mind look like when it sees through its own divisions? It looks like a world of separation. He's now going to the heart of separation itself. Not to the emptiness of me and the emptiness of you. That was in the first two foundations. That's a given, that when you start going into the third, you bring that wisdom in with you. Now what is the word? See, now it's so beautiful. It's so simple. It's the simplest thing. But not disputing is one of the hardest things, because that I'm powerless. I derive my sense of self from disputes, from contrasts, from contracting. And so if I have I can make the mind an object, like I can make anything an object, and I can have many disputes with the mind because it's not cooperating, and it never cooperates. It cooperates once in a while, but not then. What happens? You see, it's like, so now he's pushing us back. He's pushing us back away from, I mean, long ago now, he's pushing us back away from knowledge and remember everything. Now we're back into the quietness of observation. And anytime I say something, that's in dispute of something, and that is more of what needs to be seen and not argued with. So no matter what is emanating out of the mind, there is no dispute. Think what this means to your practice. If we practice from the third foundation, which I encourage you to do from time to time, you would have no dispute with whatever was arising. If you are distracted, you are distracted. If you're not distracted, you're not distracted. If your mind is one-pointed, fine. If it's not and scattered and spurious, fine. No dispute. We say, well, that's there without, like I'm just throwing the whole thing off a cliff. What's going to save me? Believe me, it's that question that maintains the paradigm we're in. And we try to solve the problem through that solution. What? I've got to have some power here to apply so that I can rearrange the discord that's there. The discord comes from the thinking in that way. Whoa. When there isn't a conflict, to get to that point, you have to have seen through the sense of self, because the sense of self, unless it's been seen through, will not be seen as an argument. It'll be seen as something I'm doing. Once we start including this sense of self within our own inquisition, then you begin to break down its hardness and its firmness and its belief systems. You can now allow yourself to enter the third foundation without argument that I am still around. You see, all these things build upon themselves just so effectively. So now I'm sitting, and we will do a guided meditation. And there's not a thing, everything, the rug has been completely pulled out from my world. And even the voice in the head, which is always my assurance point, was always the place where I could rest to get a ponderance of what was occurring. I see that as more judgment upon what's occurring. I'm more trying to control the knobs of what's occurring. And because long ago, I have understood that now does not exclude the voices of ponderance. The voices of ponderance are not somewhere else. It's now too. T-O-O. And so, because awareness only knows now, it is now, and can and will always arise now, that everything can be seen, even if it's thought to be outside of now, can be seen within now, because nothing is outside of now. Now, I don't have it, there's not a thing I can do. But there is something that comes in that absence. Instead of feeling helpless, I mean, you can go back into bring yourself back in to an emotion that feels despondent and discouraged, and you will reform yourself and have the world of discouragement be the world you operate within this paradigm, if you can go that direction. Or you can be quiet. Because now no state of mind has an alternative. No state of mind has an alternative. If I seek an alternative, I stay within this realm. That is not the end of the cosmos. That is not the final Buddhist teaching. And it's fine to have skillful means until you get to this point. Then you pull it out. This is not the land of skillful means and practices we're in now. And that's how the paradigm shifts. That's how it shifts. And what comes in is not a divided mind, but a unified mind. And once the mind is unified so that it's no longer barking orders to its opposite, it's gone. Oh, I don't mean that you don't have thoughts that emotions that come, but the space that holds it becomes the predominant feature, not the internal conflict from which it arises. And it can be seen as easily empty as any other object. From awareness, not from me. Because as soon as I make a statement about what I see, then I've created the opposite of what it can't be. And that's dispute enough to maintain the paradigm we're in. We fall back into stillness. We don't pursue it. You're on the end of a boat and you fall back into the water from the stern because you have no place to go. And you know that now because you've seen all along the way how it's just my additions have been the self-created effect upon me and the world I view. And I'm tired of creating the world. And I'm willing to see what's on the other side of that perceived nothing, because I'm not willing to maintain the world as it is. I'm not willing to do it. And then stillness. Stillness does not exclude anything. It does not exclude the forms of the world. Because when something is nothing, you've also given permission for it to be something. You're not arguing that something has an opposite called nothing. Because you realize that any opposite reforms everything. So sometimes you read a good book. And sometimes there's just being still. And sometimes you're saying, hi, how are you? How's the tea? Oh, yes, my tea. That's all Zen. That's all of Zen right there. So that's it. It's just that. No conflict, because there's no, oh, wait a minute, I've got to get, why am I making something out of the tea? Anyway, I like that tea. I'm not supposed to like it. Don't do that. We're talking about the third foundation now. We're not talking about you becoming a good yogi. See, you can feel it just by talking about it and talking within the direction of it. The whole of the room starts to be encased, starts to be covered. Jesus said, heaven spreads itself all out across the landscape and no one can see it because they don't have the eyes to look. Or something like that. And stillness is just, it never gets old. Whatever arises within it without the tension of its opposite. Therefore, the mind, it doesn't matter what the mind is doing. Doesn't matter what the mind is conceiving. It doesn't matter what the mind is emitting, because it's held within that discernment. And the discernment is not in dispute with it. And can rest completely quiet with whatever expression of appearance it is. Why isn't it in dispute of it? Because it's nothing. And stillness sees the nothing that we hold to be the something. Isn't it like the Mona Lisa squared? It's like so beautiful. And it was always available. It wasn't 2 million years later, 200,000 zillion lifetimes. It's just that we didn't want it. We didn't really get interested in it. We wanted ourselves, because ourselves held the functionality that we needed to survive when we were out on the Serengeti plains. And survival has a more basic need than spiritual evolution. But now we've survived. Now we can ask questions about that survival, about what survives, that we never could. Okay, so this is a direct, this is the Buddha's direction. If you take it up, fine. If you don't take it up, fine. You see, that discriminating discernment, non-discriminating discernment, has to be incorporated with, embodied within all of us. A teacher can't say, you should be doing this, because that's creating the tension from which the student lives. You do it, you do it. You don't do it, you don't do it. Whenever you're ripe enough, whenever the maturity a view is fulfilled, that's when you'll do it. Now you can speed that maturity, as I mentioned yesterday, by looking sincerely looking at the formations we've created and the formation that's creating the formation. Sincerely looking at that and test the hypothesis. Is this world as good as it was promised to be? Just things to start backing us off from the invested interest we have in all of this. Because as long as the vested interest is greater than the need to be truthful and know, then the interest will win out. It's that simple. And the interest will win out as long as you're convinced that it's giving you something and denying the fact that you're projecting the very value you give it from yourself. We all are chasing our own tails. Now, aren't you glad you came today? Okay, all, enough. I barked pretty hard. Thank you, Miss Allen. I feel so studious up here with my books and glasses and pens, tables. But it has nothing to do with that. Nothing. Doesn't have a little bit to do with that. It has nothing to do with that. So when last we left the adventure into our fourth foundation. Don't send me there. On the rim of the black hole. Don't push me. I'm not going to push you. But we are going to move forward. So there's a beautiful, right where we are, where our mind is so open and non-discriminatory that it's allowing whatever to be there to be there. It makes perfect Dharma sense. Because when we realize we try to impose ourselves upon what is there, we create the struggles in which the whole journey is supposed to resolve. Does it not? You see, so this third foundation is the resolution of the struggles as we've known them to be. Because when something comes up, it comes up. It's not a ponderance. It's not something I'm pondering whether I want it there or not. When we do that, it's already there. When it's already there, what are we deciding whether we want it there or not for? It's already there. So we better go to the fact that it's there and square ourselves with that. And the way we square ourselves without that, without forming new contention, new tensions associated with that, is to surrender any opposition to it. And then it's just there. You see? And it was the opposition that came after the event, because the opposition is the ponderance. When you ponder something, it's already there. That's why you're pondering. Should this be here? Right? It's already there. Drop the ponderance. The ponderance is you, is me, is the sense of self having some will and empowerment over the fact that it's there. It's there. Okay, so now we can drop to zero. Dropping to zero allows it to be nothing. And so it doesn't matter whether it's there or not. The ponderance is the deliberation over whether it should be. Now there is a problem with it. The problem with it is not it, it's the ponderance of it. Okay, we're on board? Because the next foundation depends upon the understanding of the third, as the third depends upon the understanding of the second, etc. Okay? So this is not light work. A lot of work has to be done with each foundation in order to move us irresolutely to the direction the Buddha is taking. And so the third foundation is that sense of non-involvement with or non-doing to. The absence of our will, of our exertion of effort or strength or contaminating influence upon the reality itself. Now when you get to that, suddenly the screen opens. My God, what am I going to do? A question may arise. What am I going to do without my willpower? Well, there's only one thing you can do, is have faith that this whole thing has been driven without you all along the way, because you haven't been, even though you think you have been, you haven't been. So it's been going on its own all the way. This whole time it's been going on its own without you. But when you think, what am I going to do now without me? Don't worry. So there's an incredible amount of faith that something else will take over. It's always been taking over, but from our perspective, it's us that have intervened so that we've made ourselves safe. And from time to time, we'll relax and let the world move as it is until it moves in a way that we don't want it to be, and then we'll exert our efforts again. But this is total faith. This is absolute faith. And what you have to, and all of the things that we've disputed, all the mental activities that we've been disputing for so long, we have to relax to. This is it. This is it. And suddenly, in that absoluteness, it has to be an absolute it. It doesn't matter, because in the absolute it, it becomes as empty as it will always has been. It was only our need to act upon it that made it the fullness of a problem. It made it into something. Remember how the contingency of me and the object arise together. So if I have a problem with, the problem arises with me. Now I don't have a problem with, and it doesn't become a problem. All right, so this is really important stuff here. Now, so the third foundation takes us right to that point where we see our powerlessness and the need for absolute faith. And it begins to show us a dimension of consciousness. And I want to talk about consciousness a little bit. A dimension of consciousness that is perfect without our involvement. And it can actually be seen as it's experienced and embodied, as we learn to be able to allow things to be just as they are without recourse, then the world, that allows the view of consciousness to transpire that shows its perfection. The view of perfection needs to have us in resolution to the imperfection of our will. You see? These two things arise together. When we are ready to relax our will, what it shows us is the perfection of what's always been. As long as we're acting upon, it's imperfect. And the imperfection is another expression of consciousness. Now we're moving towards different expressions of consciousness here. There is no expression that is an absolute. This is so important. That is the absolute depiction of the universe. It's like having one of those view things. We had cards in the old days, and you would click, 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 click. Okay, now we're at the click of the absolute perfection. Before, we were at the struggle. Everything's a struggle. I've got to fix everything. Click, oh, it's all perfect. Now there's a lot of cards on this, or a lot of pictures on this card. So stay with me here. But that sense of perfection, that resolves the conflictual errors that we have made. Every elevation of consciousness resolves the one below it. But none of them are absolute truths in and of themselves. They're all relative to how we're seeing them and what we're doing in relationship to them. This is so interesting, because we've always been trying to get to a certain level of consciousness, which is relative. But each one needs to be practiced so that our bodies are become embodied within that. We begin to move from that particular depiction. So in the perfection of it, you don't make contention where there isn't any. And that doesn't mean that we become naive and whatever's happening, we just roll over, because there's a deeper discernment that each level of consciousness, as it thins out, so do we thin out. There's so much to say. I just read the book. Okay. Much of the struggles were around the content of our minds early on. The egoic content, the egoic struggles. I don't like myself. All the kind of thoughts, the emotions, all of that stuff, that forms a particular heaviness called egoic consciousness. That's the consciousness of separate things. Okay, that's a dense consciousness, very dense, very troublesome. It's a relative truth. It's not an absolute truth. And then as we begin to have less and less involvement, which means less ego and intentionality and will, we begin to see from different expressions of consciousness. Because we're less involved in them. The more involved we are, that consciousness becomes a consciousness of struggle. The less involved, it shows us a consciousness of... Every consciousness... Okay, we're not completely free of self just because the ego is in abeyance here. Every expression of consciousness has a subtle sense, I call it a film of self, that knows that we're viewing oneness, or we're viewing perfection, or we're viewing that. It's like a little fly on the wall of consciousness that relates back what is going on. That's still a sense of self. It still holds a very slight separation of forms. Okay, so we're not done. This, I'm telling you, this is the cosmos ended. The ending of it, not the fly consciousness of it. So whenever there's an experience, there's an experiencer. There can't be. The Buddha's dependent origination demands that when there's an experience, there's an experiencer. You can't have an experience, no matter how refined and ethereal, without an experiencer who's equally as refined and ethereal. Those two match. The quality of myself and what is being seen match perfectly. The egoic consciousness of struggle and the struggles I maintain in life and what life looks like to me, those match perfectly. So we're moving through different conscious displays here. And when we get to the third foundation, that's a very refined picture of consciousness. It's the consciousness of perfection. When we're out of the picture, we see how it's always been moving and is moving. Not that everything looks pretty, but we're not viewing it from that kind of relativity. We're viewing it from the absolute whole. And from the absolute whole, it has a perfect perfection to it. But galaxies are colliding, stars are exploding. The absolute perfection of that. And so as we get to that consciousness, it's worth taking sort of psychic notes about what it was revealing and start working ourselves within that direction so that we become less and less contentious, because as these conscious factors become more observable, they are taking us out of suffering. Each one is more refined and therefore less suffering. So let me just run you through some. Because there are a lot of them, and I'll just run you through some. So there's the consciousness of perfection. Oh, everything's perfect. Some people, that's it, I don't want to go any further. I'm here, that's it. you can't stay there because it's relative, but you can keep refining your practice so that that is an encouraging and predominant form of consciousness, as you can with your struggles. It looks pretty good, and you can talk to other people about the perfection of things and all of that, or then we can, and then as we get even quieter, meaning there's even less self-involvement, and therefore more of a refined picture of what the next view is, you get to oneness or universal consciousness, or God consciousness.
Whoa.
Now you can take a seat, because the film of self can always take a seat in every form of consciousness and claim a display. And what better one than God consciousness? First, I've got to act the part. It's so ugly when you've been there and been through it that you just go, I got to get out of here. Anybody who embodies any expression of consciousness stinks. That's you and me. Because we stink from what we are taking to be true when there isn't an absolute true in the relativity of consciousness. But what about universal consciousness? My teacher, one of my teachers, Nisargadatta Maharaj, used to have us become so refined that universal consciousness was the point of departure to the fourth foundation. That's where, now we're on the fourth foundation, where the view, this all is being driven by sincerity. Anywhere you're not sincere, you're going to rest. If you don't want to move on, you will rest wherever you are. And you'll claim some personal qualities of yourself in relationship to that. You'll think of yourself as being perfect, no matter what I do. And I can't do anything wrong because everything is perfect. You'll claim some distorted view when you claim anything within a conscious expression. I don't know if I've taken Sims this quite this far out. But we're going to end the cosmos. And so are all of our most precious desires are going to be, you know, when we've been begrudged our very spirit by the abuse of society, don't you think you want to be God? You see, it's only sincerity that moves us on. How about emptiness? But things are empty, relatively. That's a view of consciousness. Everything's empty. And therefore, it doesn't matter what I do, because it's all empty anyway. I'm not hurting anybody. See, you can take it, you can manifest that in a distorted way. It's all empty. It's all God, it's all. That's delusion. I wrote down a whole bunch of them. Timelessness, right? There's no time. These are insights. These are insights. You actually see the universe from a timeless perspective. You see the universe from an empty perspective. You see the universe from everything being God. These are absolute perspectives, insights of the universe. But the universe isn't one thing. If it were, it would be cast in that one thing. And it isn't cast in anything, which is true emptiness. Even to call it empty is to cast it into something that it is not. And so from the fourth foundation, there's just the sincerity is so strong that we're not going to light upon a thing. And yet the formations continue to occur. Formations continue to occur. And so you get so thin. I have such a nice description in the book, I keep thinking maybe I'll just do that. I was reading it upstairs. So the Buddha does something unusual in the fourth foundation. Since awareness has no observable qualities, he describes what is seen within awareness rather than the seeing that is awareness. It is a switch of figure and ground, and it can be very difficult to make this shift unless we have understood where the Buddha was taking us through the first three foundations. Think of the first three foundations as looking through the sense of self that is formed by words in trying to reach the formless. All our attempts in vain until we realize the intrinsic emptiness of all things and come to stillness, which is the point of the first three foundations. The fourth foundation further integrates us into this emptiness by undertaking a shift of identity where awareness is having the experience of self rather than the sense of self having the experience of awareness. So that's where now our back is, there's nothing behind us now. This is getting really interesting because now we're going into the black hole. So there's nothing on our back, there's no me to give up anymore. And yet the formations of consciousness persist. And because we are human beings, we keep reifying ourselves within different expressions of consciousness or thoughts as they do arise. And so in order to release or surrender that reification, the Buddha reminds us of his teachings. Not a specific teaching, because all the teachings, if you put all the teachings into a funnel, what would come out the end after all this stuff was filtered through, the thing that would come out from all the teachings would be surrender. And so his teachings represent that word. And so as we are going through this systematic presentation of consciousness with the ever-present fly, even the fly becomes part of the scenery. And now we are back against awareness that has no content. Awareness with content is consciousness. The different displays of relativity. Awareness without content is the absolute. Is the formless. And it's dark, but alive. It isn't nothing, and yet it isn't something. And all manifestations, all expressions of consciousness come out of, are birthed out of that darkness. And it becomes the known presentation of one's life. And the resolution of spiritual journey is to live with the back, your back, against the black darkness of nothing. This is long, long past selflessness. This is void, the void with a capital V. While the presentations of life move on in front of you. Sometimes taking the form of struggle, sometimes taking the form of emptiness, sometimes taking the form of oneness, sometimes taking this form, that form, object consciousness, all forms of consciousness. But that which gives rise to all consciousness, zzz, is the ever-present mystery of being. And that's where he's taking us. So this fourth foundation is so exquisite. But in Zen it said that the awakened experience is not the end of enlightenment, it's the beginning. Because one has to come back in without objectifying any expression of consciousness or pitting one against the other. So the same thing as in the third foundation, where everything was allowed to be just as it is, so too consciousness is allowed to be just what it is in that expressional moment. And all of the different expressions of consciousness that play through us is the perfection of the universe. And each of our abiding roles within it. And so there's no wanting universal consciousness over wanting to see emptiness. When you want to see emptiness because you're so full and heavy laden that you're dreaming for some part of yourself that you've realized long ago or sometime as an alternative state. It's no better than wishing for some other desire for this, for that. Well, consciousness plays the same theme upon itself. The mind doesn't stop finding alternatives, even when it's that refined. And to live fully without alternatives. That's the end of suffering. Even as manifestations arise. This is a surrender game. Land anywhere, and you have created the necessary conditions for the continuation of struggle. And the only place one can land that is not another place is the present. Because the present includes all spaces and all times and all dimensions. It's without limits. And until one fully realizes and abides within that, then we're just really playing spiritual games, substituting one aspect for another. Now, I don't want to leave you with your back against the black hole of nothing. I want to encourage alive living. Even though few of us may have understood completely what I've been saying, it doesn't mean that you can't align yourself with what I'm saying and move forward towards it. And to do that, we have to live the awakened values that all of the different expressions of consciousness have given us, and the wisdom that we've accrued through having gone through all of this, which is surrender and release. When one awakens out of the different displays, the heart becomes the predominant organ. And so the awakened values of love are a good yellow brick road to travel. Now, another one that's very helpful, and each of us may have within us certain awakened values that we treasure. Please go to those as your path forward. Perhaps it's the love of truth. And you will develop such an ear, whenever there's an awakened value that resonates deeply, you'll develop such a sensitive ear to that which is not true. Because you're being governed by what is true. And it will never be someone else's truth over and above my own. It will be me exploring the truth I just heard to see if it has any relevance or any absoluteness to my person. So the tuning fork gets very, very refined. Or love. I mean, what we mean by that has so many dimensions of ignorance. And so as you start walking that road, the definition of it changes immensely. It becomes so refined as to what love is. And each time we take an awakened value and we move it in the direction of that refinement, where all awakened values end is in awareness. Because ultimately, that's the source of all values. And so we may have completed the four foundations, but you're never complete. Never complete. This is a lifetime engagement. But the embodiment of that learning is where the majority of our time is spent. And it's one of the weakest expressions of this tradition's manifestation. We're very good sitters. We're very good meditators. We're less adept at the embodiment of what sitting means. What does sitting mean when you sit down? Are you trying to get out of yourself? If it is, then that's what your awakened value is going to look like. It's going to look like more struggle. What does sitting mean when you sit down? Why are you sitting? You see, each of these questions take us to a very deep introspection of what we're doing. And the reasoning that we have for what we're doing is what drives us forward. And it will show that expression of consciousness to us. So as we walk this road, look at what we are creating from our intentionality and desires, because that's what we're going to find as the embracing consciousness that holds us. And all of this drives us, another word for surrender is stillness. To be still with something is to surrender it. So is your practice moving you towards greater stillness? What expression of consciousness are you, each of us, creating as home? Okay. So a couple of things is that the batteries of my hearing aids went out. For those of you who are old enough to know what that's like, is that you go from hearing pretty well to hearing very little. So the questions need to be, I may have somebody close to me here repeat the question. Hopefully I'll repeat the question to you back again if I understand it right. So with all that, maybe we'll settle on what, often my wife tells me I go off in a complete tangent because I didn't hear the question correctly. She always says, it's good though, it was a good answer. Good answer without a question, that's an answer. I want to dial back my own reaction to the word equanimity. And let me bring it in perspective. But I think it's very overused, and I think it's misunderstood terribly, as is love. But in this particular case, it feels like a model that we can practice or try to become, and that's what draws us away from what is true about us whenever we think of it as a model of something becoming. It's not. You don't become more equanimous. You don't become more loving. There is a range in which that does occur, though. There's a range within each paradigm of that. You're still within the paradigm of the laws of that paradigm, but there's a range that is what we call the spiritual path within that paradigm. And Awakening, the book Awakening I wrote, I think covers that trajectory. So we may start off very reactive, and we start learning how to work with the mind and all the tensions of the mind, and we start having a different relationship to our thoughts and to our emotions, et cetera, et cetera. And so we become less reactive, quite naturally, as we become more conscious of what the mind is doing, but also more adept at being able to work with the different levels of intensity the mind offers. And so that makes us less reactive. And that sort of says, I'm on the trajectory of equanimity. Well, if you think of it like that, you are. You are becoming less reactive. If you keep the definition of equanimity as being less reactive. But most of us think of it as a flat line in which there's no reaction at all. And that's never going to happen within this particular paradigm. Beautification, mind beautification, can happen and does. And is lovely to see. And the further you get towards the outer reaches of this paradigm in those more less contentious qualities, like equanimity, like love, like generosity, patience, the paramis basically, there's still a way of that we self-evaluate those qualities that keep a certain tension. But from those outer reaches, it's much easier to cross into the next paradigm than from the left side of the trajectory, where you're very reactive and don't understand the mind, completely unconscious, and very few of us can move from there to there. So that's mostly what the spiritual journey does, is it takes us along a path of smoothing out the rough lumps that keep us so self-contained, and then allow from that a general exploration which leads us into what equanimity really means, or what love really means, which is not within this paradigm, but within the next. You see? That doesn't mean you can't have moments of true love or moments of true ease. The one paradigm often interjects itself into the other. And then what we do, because our base camp is still in this paradigm, is we think, oh, we got to get back to that one. I want more of that. And then we make it into a conflict, you see? But it's not unusual for people to have moments of deep feelings of gratitude and love and generosity and patience, etc., etc., because this other paradigm is that close at hand. It's just a matter of relaxing to the place where we're beyond disagreement. But because that's not the frame of our reference, the frame of our reference is something vastly different, we think, oh, how did I do that? And how do I get back to it? And that's the true state of me, not this one. And so the whole thing becomes lumped up again. And so many of us move in that kind of direction, and you can make it a lot easier not to have models for yourself that you're trying to improve into. Don't try to be perfect in love. Don't try to be perfect in equanimity. Don't do that. Just see what it means to be reactive and release the need, release the ignorance surrounding that reactivity. And you'll find yourself naturally moving in that direction without creating a new goal for yourself, which only leads to more trouble. Does that make sense? Okay. So, any questions? Yeah. Yes, Krista.
So you presented this in a sort of sequential progression over the weekend. So during the dyad and then the walking period afterwards felt somewhat like in an otherworldly place. I don't know what.
Say again, yourself.
Another world. Another
world.
Worldly place.
Yeah.
That's fairly new.
To you?
Yes.
Came to you?
Well, it felt like moments of not disputing anything.
Beautiful.
Felt like.
Beautiful.
And then I thought, wow, this could be helpful in going backwards to the third, second, and first foundation.
Yes.
Not from the first.
No.
Laying it on the first.
Yes.
But
no, exactly.
Folding back.
Yes. Each teaches itself the other, doesn't it?
A new way to not have a dispute with feelings.
Yes. 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 You know, like all phases, they go backward as well as forward. The fourth teaches us about the first, and the second teaches us about, you know, each one teaches us about the other. If you've ever practiced this dependent origination, the 12 steps, which I did as a monk for years, each step holds all the other steps. And so you could go from any step back to the ignorance or whatever step you're on, and you can see the link up of all the other, and so too in these four foundations. Now, what generally happens is that the more you abide within a different reference, a different perceptual reference of life, then the more time you'll spend there as opposed to the earlier phases of discord. Why would you go back? Why would you want, you just don't have any you know how to get out. I'm saying this completely wrong, but anyway, just listen to it and then put it into the words of this weekend. But you know how to get out. You know how to release yourself from that kind of tension. So you don't, why would you want to stay within that kind of bitterness? You don't, you know. So surrender becomes a very automatic release from the turmoils of a particular frame of reference, a particular consciousness. So you don't spend as much time in dispute with self or other. And then, so, but that doesn't mean you never go back there. Situation, when the Buddha said, "Oh, Mara, I see you," that, because he was revisiting an earlier paradigm, you know, that was where Mara lives. He goes, "Okay, gotcha, surrender, out of here." I mean, that's, so, it's the same thing, you know, you just, it doesn't mean it'll never come up in you, but it gets pretty clear that there's only trouble in this one. So you don't do it from aversion, you do it from wisdom. It's like, you know, there's no reason to stay in troubled land, you know, it's like, so that's, the trajectory is more towards the more refined areas of consciousness, and therefore the later phases of the four foundations become the practices of choice. But there's still times to go back to the body. I mean, all of us get lost in the confusion of, I mean, all of us have to ground ourselves from time to time and just take a breath. But it's that quick, you see. I mean, just as I said, take a, the paradigm shifted. So it gets automatic, really. It's not even, you're not even asking it to, or you're not, it just, because that's the frame of reference, you see? And so then, you know, then the paradigms, each of the foundations means, you can use them at different times, but practices in general don't become the way towards your growth any longer. Interactions do, because there's a lot of stuff that still comes up in one in regard to interaction, or interacting socially, interacting, you know, in whatever way. And so the 10,000 enemies that keep dragging us back to other expressions of ourselves, or new learnings, mistakes being made, and the endless mistakes, and the, oh God, there I did it again, that kind of, you know, what you get a sense of is that the whole thing is becoming more and more conscious. It's spreading out. It's like going into nooks and crannies where it hasn't been. And it's endless. So there's not an end to this thing. So when we say we're fully awakened, doesn't mean, to me, that there's a moment in which there's no learning going on, where there isn't new depths of realization of consciousness. Doesn't mean that at all. At the best, it means that you're no longer at service to the conflicts of old permanently. And that no matter what shift of paradigm you're in, there's always the recognition of it being temporary, momentary. That there's a general abiding in sufficient emptiness, or what I was talking about, the absolute. That each thing is a working from that rather than from the personhood. Let's see if that's true. Did I say that right? Close.
I answered that question differently, but knowing you were framing it in terms of the absolute, but I answered it with a for some reason with a different frame, and that was that if I'm experiencing non-dispute, then I want to look at what I'm getting comfortable with. I was looking at it from a launching place to inquire, is there something, like I am dull resting at, like you're talking ingratiating, or you know, like just numbing out to? And so I was exploring it from that standpoint rather than mind is empty, and when that's there, that, you know.
Okay, so you have to be careful.
Well, I know mind's not empty, but.
No. Your question holds a double edge. The question has to do with, you know, always questioning the motivation behind whatever state you're in. So you're always actively looking at why the contentment is here. Is there, am I, you know, so you can ask too many questions of yourself and never allow yourself to settle. And stillness requires you to settle. Okay, so there's a time for questioning and a time for experiencing. And what you'll find is that when you experience it not from a grasping point of view, but from an open point of view of abiding, when you're abiding, you'll know what motivates, you know the motivation automatically, because your consciousness will be sensitive enough to have picked up that motivation. When you're in there for the craving component, then it may not, and the motivation for why you're doing or what you're doing may not be clear, and then you have to go, oh, wait a second here, I feel a tightness and a clamping, what's going on? And that leads you to the questioning, do you see? But I have known meditators who will never let themselves rest because they think questioning, and I've emphasized this a lot, that questioning is sort of the way out, which it is, except at some point it isn't. It's another practice that keeps you kind of off balance from really fully exploring and being present to the benefits of stillness. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But the other piece too, so yes, I'm hearing that, was that, well, everything, it doesn't anatta, right? It's not there permanently, so, you know, don't hang on to it
okay.
too long, because I'm expecting it. Well, I'm not expecting it. That came up too, and that's another form of the questioning. Preferring to be unsettled rather than to be still.
Yes. What's that about? Because you see, being unsettled keeps you very much there. And what anatta is not about being unsettled. So questioning should really be towards greater settlement, shouldn't it? So but you'll know when to ask questions. You just kind of automatically know that there's something back there that needs to be explored that I'm missing. And that then you'll say, no, I don't want to do that. Well, you don't want to do that. Why? Why don't you want to do that? Because it's too comfortable where I am. Well, then you better question what's going on. You know, but stillness, I never want to, there's no need to question stillness. Where are you going to go? So where are you going to go? It's like the question just, it's like, why would I? There's not even a me that wants to ask that question. I mean, it's not a question that has a great deal of egoic need. It doesn't have any egoic need, to be honest. Anyway, blah, blah. Yes?
To clarify something that came up during the meditation this morning, the guided meditation, and it had to do with when you were talking about abiding in awareness, and if you choose to do something, the awareness goes away. So are you saying that you can't be doing something and be awareness?
No, not at all. The question has to do with my comment this morning about doing something and awareness going away. When you're doing something from self-volition, you have a goal. The doing has tied to some product, some way, some upsetness in you. You're trying to get over something. You're trying to prove. right? You've got a goal that this is what you want to do. And so when you have any goal, your eyes are focused on the goal, which is future, and not upon the present. So you're not really being available to what is occurring. You're looking forward to what the future will bring, which is another form of desire, really, isn't it? Huh? So doing, most volitional doing, not action, volitional doing, perhaps I'm saying all, but I don't know all, but I would say the vast majority of volitional doing has a goal associated with it in which I am losing myself, I'm taking myself out of the present, I want to be more calm. Well, then what, we're pitting ourselves against ourselves, aren't we? I'm not calm enough, how am I doing now? I'm getting a little better now, but I'm still not where I want to be. You know, it's like that. That's the goal. Or there's no dispute to the quality of my present contentment. See, that brings you to stillness, which takes you to the contentment you desire. The lack of dispute really is where the goal is located. Not forming a goal which creates more dispute but leads us forward. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, okay, so then let me try that one. When you try that one, it's a new goal. So I don't know how to say it except that's it. You go to the point where you go, you can't go left and you can't go right, and you go, that's it. It's the way it is or it's not. It has to be the way it is. I mean, that's what woke me up to it. It's like, I can't do anything about it. You can't do anything about the present. The present, when you're doing something about it, is the past you're trying to do something about. Because it's already gone. When you wake up to the fact of what's going on, that's moved on. And you go, whoa, talk about being an old timer. This is not working. And then you go, I can't do anything. It's okay, I use this a lot, but it's a very good example. When you wake up from your sittings, you know, when you're lost in thought and you wake up and you go, yeah, all right, I woke up from my thinking. You claim all the credit. But if you look at what actually happens, the wakefulness occurred prior to the recognition that you woke up. You had nothing to say about it, but claim reference to having done it after the fact. That's the truth of everything. I think that's so interesting. Yes, sir.
So I have a question about the dazzling darkness. If there is no term that can describe the ultimate, then how did you come up with dazzling darkness?
I didn't. The Sufis did, or some such people. Yeah.
I guess you understand my question is that there's a paradox there.
Yes, but what do you? Okay, I won't say anything. How satisfying is that?
I'm not going to take your word for it. I'm just going to try and figure it out for myself.
Don't try to figure it out, because that really is going the wrong way. Just question it. Just say, okay, I want to see. Just have some intentionality. Say, okay, I want to know this. That's all. Just invite it forward. I want to know. I want to know what that is. And then be quiet enough to see it, because it's not something you're chasing. It's something that you're missing. It's already caught you. Okay. So what it requires is your willingness to let it catch you, let it show itself, let it be, it's already caught you. What it's required is for it to reveal itself to you. And usually, you know, it's like a black hole. Which may be actually what it is. Because people think black holes are terrifying, which we also think of this, and we think it's like sucking down everything, which it may be just the birth of everything. Do you know at the center of every galaxy is a supermassive black hole? Maybe it's giving birth to that galaxy. We think of it as being a monster in which it's being trapped within. Maybe it's doing just the opposite. Maybe, and I know this is not a sucking monster, this dazzling dark is what is the fabric of aliveness. It's the basic, it's the foundation. So why would I want to run from that? In fact, at some point it doesn't make sense to run from anything. Anything that's there, catch me. Just catch me. Just do it. Even Godzilla, who's coming at me, I don't care, catch me. I don't care, do it. Stomp on me, I don't care. Death, okay, it's all right. It's okay, let's go. Why not? Well, I'll miss, yeah, you'll miss, but. Like a pea. Yeah, Linda.
Ronnie, you use the expression, I think, consciousness paradigm.
Yes, paradigms of consciousness.
Would you just define that without using those two words?
I will. Okay, so. There's a set of laws that form the way we hold reality. The set of laws that we're in says, one set of law is that there's distance between you and I. And I have to, if I am to meet you, I have to traverse that distance, right? So there's time and distance. It also is a paradigm, when understood properly, of suffering, of tension, of conflict. And we're exploring how that happens within this paradigm, and it's inevitable when you have distance, because you're not operating in accordance to the deeper truths of unification of truth, of what truth is. So therefore, you're trying to recover the distance that's intrinsic, right? So there's an inherent paradox in trying to do that, and that paradox leads to a lot of rub and a lot of falsification. So that set of principles is what I call it's a way of looking at life that sees separation, that's object consciousness, that has a set of laws and principles that govern it. And then there are shifts of consciousness that lead, consciousness merely means that the laws have changed now, and suddenly there's no longer distance at one. In another expression of existence, there's no, I'm trying not to use your words, another expression of existence, those laws break down. They're no longer, and so I sense the unity that my eyes betray. And so a different organism, it's not perceptual, I mean, appearances, it's a different way of looking. It's not that appearances disappear, that people are no longer individual, you know, but something else, a different organ takes over, and that's the organ of the heart. And it senses much more accurately the truth of collective, of connection, than the old principle of the eye and the brain, which kept things distant. So it switches organs. And once you switch organs, you really switch a lot of everything, of many things. And so then that operates more from love, because that's the operating principle of the heart and of the collective truth of union. Right? Much nicer there, but we just don't believe it. That's why we don't give ourselves over to it. We don't believe it to be the true perspective of life. We believe we got to get on with our life and do what we do on this. So we hold ourselves in principle to this paradigm, even though we have intimate relationship with the others, especially if you are a Dharma student. But we don't believe it sufficiently to give ourselves over to that, and we keep living this one. That's why we have to live the other prior to awakening to the other completely. So we have the foundation necessary so that when that awakening does occur, we don't slide ourselves back into a different shift. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I'm interested in the states of mind or the conscious paradigms that happen after you see through the self sufficiently. And what you just described right now is more like shifting to the heart, but then there's also, just really interested in the ideas of are you in these different paradigms, just touching into them? Once you're close to the black hole, you can touch into emptiness and God consciousness, and that's or is it like you're living for 3 years with the universe is a dream or something like that? It seems like a lot.
You know, I'm not going to answer that because it tries to put it a methodical way it presents, and there just isn't one. It's very different for each person. Right, I'm just showing that what I really just wanted to show was that each expression of consciousness has its own value, but its own limitation. Why? Because there's still a slight sense of self that's being governed by it, and therefore a tinge of something that's inaccurate, and that continues through virtually every single shift that occurs until there is no shift, until that which gives rise to all shifts, that which gives rise to that small sense of seeming self itself, is the place where it takes over. And then there's no way to operate within that that's set out in rules, because there are no rules in that. So you operate from total spontaneity, it said, and total aliveness, and with no incongruency. Right? So the manifestation is what you become. You become the manifestation. Okay, and then something occurs in which you are asked to shovel the snow off your, and you get blisters, and it's like, like that. And then there's no dispute to that. And then you put your shovel up, and then, it's just like, it doesn't mean that you're locked into a particular perspective forever. It's those perspectives can come and go. The general way that it unfolds is you spend less time in this very individuated object conscious that's so gross that it even feels gross to enter it. It's like molasses, you go, oh well. And so when you get a feeling for that, you don't want, I use all the different wrong words. You release the need to stay there, to belong there. Although it's said that in some places, even in the hell realms of the cosmos, which I know nothing about. Anyway, I know nothing about what I'm saying now. It says that the bodhisattvas will even go to those areas to inspire those creatures in whatever realm they're in. And I can certainly see bodhisattvas coming to this one, which is pretty thick. Molasses is pretty thick. And I'm thinking, thank you. I need your light to know I'm in molasses.
So I just want to make sure I'm understanding correctly. When you say is that slight sense of self the separation between consciousness and awareness?
Yes, okay, very good. So what's the difference between consciousness and awareness? Okay, think of, I have a really good analogy in the book, and I can't remember what it is, but it has something, I can't remember. But basically, that which we fill awareness with that keeps us blinded to the awareness that's everything with, that holds it all, is the content. It's like, oh, I know you're Barbara, blah, 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 da, 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 and all the history and my own narrative and my own sense of, all of that is the content-laden component that obstructs my being able to see anything but what I'm saying to myself. So the self-talk keeps me very self-indulged. So that's consciousness, that kind of way that we have built the world to be, and our and the rules by which it operates, and our logic within it, and all of that. But it's still held within awareness. And from time to time, we can get a sense of the awareness that holds things rather than getting lost in the things itself. So we know awareness is in there somewhere. We just don't have that much access to it as we'd like, right? So as we've put less and less focus on making the content true, belief in thought is certainly one of the most viable ways that we do that. The whole thing gets quieter and there's less content. And more awareness begins to reveal itself because we're not as indulgent in the content. And there's a point where it becomes so thinned out that awareness is the obvious locator. But it doesn't mean that the self is gone. It's just transformed itself from a very content, egoic-based consciousness into the film sense of self-consciousness that still has some residue of I'm experiencing this. Without very much content at all. Well, this is interesting. That's self-consciousness. Okay, so then awareness is a wide open field with very little consciousness. Now, as even that is given up, the lights kind of go out from behind you because, okay, here's an analogy that someone used that I think is a very good one. If we have our back to the sun, you don't know the sun is shining. It's all dark, right? You're in space, and you have your back to the sun. You don't see the sunlight, because the sunlight's invisible. Okay, and then an object comes by, and you see that object lighted up by the sun. And so now you know, that's where the darkness comes from, is that there's no more objects within consciousness to lighten up the field. And so awareness without objects is the dazzling dark. And that means you're not forming anything anymore. And therefore, if you're not forming anything anymore, you're not formed anymore, even in a slight sense of being yourself. Which means you have entered aliveness itself without any ponderance. Entering aliveness itself without ponderance is freedom. It's the ponderance, the I am ponderance. The I see ponderance, even the acknowledgement of an experience is enough ponderance to keep you distant from the truth, to keep you from arising within. Abiding within life is the acclimation of the journey. You see? So, of course it's going to be dark, because it's not going to show you anything. There's no content. That was a very good answer. Yes.
One of them is third foundationally. At times, things are moving well in that direction. I'm less invested in the thoughts and emotions and things like that. As that happens, I've been noticing kind of the place that I'm living more is like this watcher of those things. I think you referred to it as a witnesser, and I was wondering if you have anything to say about how to look at that.
The witnesser is a phase of most people's practice. It's a very useful phase because it shows you a lot that you haven't been able to see from the non-witnessing perspective, and be more conscious. You become more conscious of some of the content that has been ruling you that you haven't seen because you were embedded in within that content, reactive to it, all right? So the witnesser is a very quiet sense of self-dialogue. That is, what the witnesser is feels like the place in which witnessing is occurring. But what's really is, it's not a place where witnessing is occurring, it's the way, place where I'm commentating inwardly about what I'm seeing. And it's very subtle, and it can be just like, oh, that's interesting, God, that's really cool. And it's really a movement from the egoic consciousness, which you had mentioned is full of, you know, the emotions and all that, to that beginning of that wisp of self-consciousness that has a handle on what's occurring, but isn't forefront. So now you can make your, you can make it even more quiet by bearing witness, by not bearing witness, wrong word, by awareness, allowing that sense of position of witnessing to be, to abide within awareness. So awareness is seeing that, but not from a new vantage point. It will happen automatically with you. It'll start, it will seem as if you, the witnessing is here and you're seeing like that. And then as you quiet and are willing to pick up subtle thoughts at a very quiet level, you'll find that awareness is suddenly outside of your, outside of you. It's seen from, you might say, from behind you or around you. It's seeing the very thing that you're seeing, or that is being seen. But it's not coming from a placeholder, it's not coming from a position. Okay, so that's then the movement from what I would call witnessing mindfulness to just awareness. So you have to prove to yourself that awareness pre-exists your formation and holds your formation, or you're going to always think that awareness comes from your formation, from you. Even as subtle as the witness is, it still has a sense that the awareness is being derived from that position. And it's not. And it will come to you just in your intentionality and your willingness, not in your rush or your impatience, but in your willingness to hear the witnessing center in a, itself. So you're turning awareness back in on the witness and showing it as being just more subtle chatter. Okay?
Just try to include it in the whole.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, just see if you can catch a sense of being aware of the position that the witness has. Yes, exactly. Yes, it is another piece of content. And we just, because it's so subtle and sounds so damn true, it convinces us that we're there. And so it takes a while, but it's just, it's a phase of practice, not to think that there's something wrong. There's nothing wrong. It's a good, and a lot of benefits coming out of it. Yeah, it's just, it's still just a...
I just wondered what she said.
Oh. Whether the witness is another piece of content, it is. It's noise. It's not you. You are noise. Track down the noise, you've tracked yourself down, really. Okay. I gotta go. Okay, so I wanna say some things. First of all, how much I deeply love each and every one of you. I don't say that like, oh, I love you, I love you. I don't do that. I really mean it. I really mean it. And part of it is just the spirit of the occasion, but part of it is the longevity of relationship that some of you bring. And I know what goes beyond this, behind the scenes of a situation like this, and I want to thank the volunteers for their... This thing runs on your energy, on everyone's energy. You can't be passive in the Sangha. If you're passive in the Sangha, you're not fully involved in the Sangha. And so to be able to work effectively, to make it work through all of our energies, that's what it means to carry this thing forward. And more than any one of the volunteers, I want to honor the former and current board presidents. And there are four of them in the room. And I'm not going to have you stand up and embarrass you, but you know who you are. And I have a deep love for you. Okay, all. Okay, so don't let today confuse you. I went very deep, very far, pushed you. If anything, challenge yourself with an intention to know what was said and to live and abide with what was said. See if it's true for you. Maybe I'm making this up. Maybe I just wrote a book to sell to get money. should have written a novel. Anyway, trust your own experience, not what other people tell you. And thank you. Mm-hmm.